Hello, 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 and welcome to the fourth episode of our coverage of the 77th edition of the Cannes Film Festival. This is Conversations. I'm Eliana.
And I'm Patrick. Hi.
And today we have a little guest, Łukasz Manikowski.
Hi, it's nice to be here. Thanks for having me. Yeah.
Łukasz is a programmer at the Five Flavors Film Festival in Warsaw, which this year will be in its 18th edition, I believe. And he also does a lot of things. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Yeah, a lot of things is a big naming for that. But I do film criticism. I write from festivals mostly. I try to cover festivals mostly about Asian cinema. And I also do research. I managed to do PhD on Japanese New Wave. And my background is Japanese studies as well. So I'm sort of naturally and organically gravitating towards Asian cinema usually. And since Five Flavors is also about Asian cinema, this is the sort of films that I'm usually watching. And I believe that's part of the reason why you decided to have me here today.
That is correct. Today we were thinking about talking about some of the Asian films in the festival that are appearing across all the sections, really. We're hoping to talk about one, the Jia Zhangke, Caught by the Tides, or Feng Liu Yi Dai in Chinese, and that appeared in competition this year, as well as a special screening in the special screening con premiere, or is it just a special screening in general?
I think it's just a special screening.
Okay,
yeah.
Special screening of the Lou Ye, an unfinished film, which the Chinese title is Yi Bu Wei Wan Cheng, the Dian Ying, I believe.
Does it mean something different?
It basically means the same thing. A film that is never to be completed.
Okay. Because we will talk about the Jia Zhangke that's a bit different. You know,
yes.
In the translation.
That is true. And finally, we wanted to try to talk about a film in the Kenzen, the cineast Desert of Namibia. I actually don't know if there is a Japanese title, but...
It is. Namibia no Sabaku, which means basically the deserts of Namibia. The desert or the deserts, it's as in Chinese, it's not specific whether it's plural or not. But it's funny because this is the same word. No, it's actually not the same word. It's a different word that was used for Sunano Onna, the woman in the dunes. Mm. So, but there is no desert in Japan. Mm. And I made a research on deserts in use of deserts in Japanese cinema. So, yeah, that's sort of... I'm quite a nerd in the context of Japanese desserts, but they're none in Japan. Yeah,
good to have you on for that reason as well.
And that is by director
Yokoyama Naka. Yeah,
Yokoyama Naka,
whom some people might know from Amico, that played in Berlin a few years ago. I saw it a bit later, I think. But yeah, I think this is basically her second film. It's her sophomore film.
Yeah.
I think she was involved in another like omnibus project where, you know, different filmmakers could contribute to one anthology type of film. But yeah, this is... And Amiko was also rather short. I think there was like 60 minutes or so. Yeah. Do you want to start with that one, or do you want to start with the big one today? That would be the competition, Jia Zhangke.
Yeah, let's start with the smaller one. Let's highlight it first.
Right, and perhaps, I mean, arguably all of those films are very intimate, but this to me seemed particularly, you know, on the, yeah, more emotionally difficult spectrum, side of the spectrum here at the festival. Yeah, what kind of film is that? It's very meandering, it's very difficult to categorize, I think, but it's about a woman who works in a beauty salon.
Mm.
And this leads to a few very funny scenes. But yeah, what she's doing there is basically she's removing hair of certain body parts for customers and through laser technology. But yeah, that's not really like the centerpiece of the film, but it's... gives you some context. And yeah, what kind of movie is that? To me, it shook me quite a bit. Mm. I found that to be quite devastating because I could sort of relate to how, yeah, I think it's not too much if I reveal that there seems to be some sort of mental illness that that haunts the protagonist, and the way the movie captures that felt, from what I can tell, very true to life. Yeah, Ukrish, how have you experienced that film?
Yeah, I was thinking of that from the very beginning, because I think in the film description in the festival catalog, there is mentioning that she has bipolar or something like that. And from the start, I think it's a bit of a spoiler in that context, because the less we know, the less we can anticipate. And like you said, the film is very meandering, so it's sort of a quest of finding what's going on with the main protagonist, which at times is very annoying, very insecure, but also you can sympathize with her on a very basic level, because she's just going through a lot and she's just a very young person. And for me, this was something you could also relate to. And I think this film in general is going to resonate a lot more with people who went through different sort of toxicity in the context of relationships. And I think what is very unique in this film is that there's not a lot of films that are so open about this particular topic in the context of Japanese modernity, that it reveals a lot of context dealing with mental health, but also how it's institutionalized and in what sort of things nowadays youth are facing in the context of very modernized society. So for me, it was definitely these topics that align in a very interesting narrative, because it's also very appealing in the context of visual language. It's that sort of story, which is, I think it's just sort of very appealing on the level of visuals, not so heavy, not so focus on this obtrusive or very imposed symbolism, and also in context of depicting the city, I think it might be also very appealing, because Tokyo, and the film is set in Tokyo, and we have a lot of scenes taking place outside, we also have those cramped apartments and sort of look into the lives of those young people. How are they dealing with everyday life, this mundane things, routine and stuff like that, and how reality is connected with work, which is also not, as you said, the most usual work as she's doing. She's in a beauty salon. My mother is actually running a beauty salon, so it's sort of funny from the private perspective as well. But I was very surprised in how this film deals with this depiction of mental health, because I think it's quite mature in the context of that we have a lot of things on the surface. We have a lot of context, a lot of things just happen, but there is not a lot of things like there are no solutions, basically.
And also it's not really specific, right? Yeah. Like they have some illusions as to, you know, the like, perhaps bipolarism or something, but they don't actually identify it as such. It's just one of the many possible diagnoses.
Mm-hmm. Yes, there's something that's just with this sort of issues of the time, like what is the cause of it? And even if you are able to potentially name what the malady is this going to help? Is this going to even cause anything to improve? And I think that the film is... it plays very well with that in the portrait of just what it means to be a young person in, more specifically in Japan, but also dealing with this type of apathy towards society. And we hear in very interesting ways news, or just we hear the sound plays a big role in a unique way in this film.
And perhaps in this context, can we talk about this opening scene? Because it's not very it's rather inconspicuous, but if you pay attention, like there's a lot going on, because especially as a non-Japanese speaker, I think you are more directed towards it, because we have two lines of subtitles there. Mm-hmm. And this sort of reflects perhaps how our protagonist perceives the world, you know, like two things that come at her at the same time, and she can't really decide where to focus mm-hmm. on which aspect of her life to focus on.
Which leads to a question, what sort of person is she? Is she like bored or mm-hmm. Falling into apathy? Or is she, I don't know, in this sort of spectrum? And I love that scene. It's got me like on the hook, and I immediately started to be interested in where this story gonna go, because from the start it's just very interesting, very ambiguous character that sort of is bored but not necessarily. And from the start we get to see that her decision making is sort of ambiguous, I guess.
Mm. Yeah, and these men that she doesn't really pay attention to, but somewhere they talk about Japanese society as a whole in much grander and perhaps more, you know, simplistic terms, but that also draws her attention there in that scene. And I love how she interacts with her friend, like she meets a friend in that scene, and you can't really tell if she's interested in her at all either. You know, it's but the friend, she seems so desperate for connection and for love, which often seems to be a big theme in Japanese films these days as well.
Yeah, I think it reveals a wider image of a wider generational image, perhaps, because what they're talking about is presumably a suicide of their old friend back mm-hmm. from the school, and the way they talk about it is somewhat light. It is like almost laughing about mm-hmm. it. It's not that they're super serious about a topic. And they seem to, not to enjoy it, but they seem to be very casual about...
Yeah, I think she doesn't even remember who that person was,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yes. Yeah. And there's like untangling something from the past, from the memories, where did they meet and something. And they're just like casually talking about, that person just, you know, died, committed a suicide. And yeah, that's life. And I think it's... I said it is generational because I think this film in general depicts people in their early 20s from a perspective of a director who's in her late 20s right now, which is also interesting. Yamanaka-san was born in 1997, who is a very young director premiering in Cannes. I mean, it's a big, big thing. And when she stood on a stage presenting the film and introducing it, she said that it's a film born out of energy of young people. It's a film about youth. And with the way I'm reading this, it's sort of a generational tale. Not that it's very pivotal or seminal in the context of representation, but it's clearly something I think it comes from a person who's very young and connects with very young people. Because many young filmmakers in Japan, they tend to depict families, mm-hmm. generational images of families or older people. I think there's a tendency to pinpoint that. And there is a lot of films that depict young people. They're like, but they're very super independent, like low key made, no budget at all. But with this film, I think it kind of stands out is that it has very decent production values and very precise storytelling. But at the same time, it is a meandering film that is seeking something, and that answer probably never comes as a clear one, which I really like about the film.
Mm. Yeah, and I feel like even if one has no connection at all to either themselves with depression or just people in their environment, but I think the film gets it right to depict her in a way that is consistent in her inconsistencies. Mm. Like mm-hmm. there's this scene when her former boyfriend, you know, seeks her out, and just through the pity he's able to evoke, is able to reach her at all, and that, you know, occurs again. And I think we talked about The Other Way Around, one of my favorite films this year at Cannes. Mm-hmm. And I think here repetition is also key to the film overall.
Mm. Yes, I can see that. I think this is also becomes a bit of a theme, but in terms of sort of searching for an oasis or some form of healing or some form of like medication And there's also this in the repetition of what she goes to sort of make herself feel perhaps that she is elsewhere. This, unfortunately, I think, I don't know if it's revealing too much to say, so I won't really say it, but it's just, she finds herself using technology.
Oh,
and
but
watching
that one
videos.
Zoom shot on her phone, I think that was incredible.
Yes, I yeah. Really, and really, it's so difficult, because even how the females and the males are depicted, mm-hmm. there's something so very bleak about it that everyone is sort of in the wrong to some degree, but there's nothing that anyone can do about that. And that the way that she ping-pongs between having some event that is out of the norm for her, but like the suicide of a friend that we just mentioned earlier, this is something that's taken as, oh, it's a non-event. So when something out of the norm occurs, it's only like marginally just different than something that usually might happen. And I think this is depicted very well, because there are a few episodes of events that happen that sometimes are just brushed off, or that sometimes can be, oh, that's very horrible. That's a
very confident
or even cringy,
right?
Yeah,
like they don't try to psychologize the characters, mm-hmm. and they don't try to explore psyches in a way we've seen a thousand times before. It rather leaves us alone with these scenes and leaves us behind, basically. And these scenes often still echo within us, and we have to think about it. Mm-hmm. But it's not that they are then discussing them, you know, at all. Or like, no, that's not part of what this movie is. And sort of, it's sort of upsetting that, you know, she goes from Amiko to this film. You know, you would hope for something more positive, but then on the other hand, of course, that makes it such a good film. Yeah. I think we can transition to the next one, right? Because we also have to look at the time here. And do you want to go to the Lu Ye? Lu Ye.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Eliana, did you want to introduce us to this film?
To an unfinished film. So an unfinished film is, I don't even, in some sense, it's almost ruining it for me. Mm. I feel like there's been an influx in a certain type of filmmaking that blurs the boundary of two categories, and to almost name it changes something. I don't know if you feel that way, as if to just say, oh, this is a spoiler alert, but not really at the same time, a docu-fiction at its core. Because obviously one shouldn't necessarily start that way, but it's a film about a director who discovers footage from 10 years ago, and he decides to revisit it in 2019, and he decides that he wants to have the main protagonist play and the role and finish the rest of the film. And so we watch as
a crew. And
perhaps
a good way to introduce that mm-hmm. is the first scene, right? The very first scene,
yes.
Which I found brilliant.
Yes, it was really good. They just discover a hard drive, and they plug it in, and they discovered that they have files there that they've forgotten about.
Right, but they need this huge old Mac Pro, you know, this huge tower,
yes.
And they sort of unearth that.
And they screw it and they unearth it. And then the screen comes on, and there's a little, like a traditional calligraphy painting on the screensaver. And they're like, oh yeah, that's class.
Old school.
So, yeah.
And it's so funny because, of course, that's not so long ago, but then again, it sort of is as well. And
it feels like it, yeah.
Yeah, and we forget how dated this technology is now, because it seemed at the time, you know, it seemed like a Mac Pro back then was the best, one of the best computers you could have, you know, and now it's like this huge sort of useless tower that's just standing there, and they're all just applauding that they can make it run, basically. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's a great opening for this film, I think.
But then mm-hmm. they realize that the film they have is without sound, and they play it. And it's absolutely wonderful, because we watch a short glimpse of the film with those actors, and then they realize, oh, we have to connect it with the sound. So they go back to the sound designer. He comes with his hair drive mm-hmm. and they connect it with it. And then we rewatch it, but with sound, and it's completely different this time around. Amazing opening. And I was like totally absolutely in love from the first moment of the film. And I felt it's gonna be like this, about just, you know, walking around an old gone piece and just sort of reconstructing it and shooting new stuff. But it appears, well, wait a minute, it's more into it and it's more complicated because we have COVID and pandemic of coronavirus at some point. Yeah.
Yes. And just like you said, just the recent sort of trauma of our past 4 or 5 years now, I can't even believe that that much time has already passed. But at the same time, it still feels like it was yesterday. But there's also an amnesia in some sense of what has occurred.
Yeah, and if you feel like a lot of people feel rather allergic to that entire subject, right? They don't want to be confronted with that again. They feel like, oh, I've experienced that. I lived through that. And there were also a lot of COVID films already in one way or the other. And I got the sense that many people were just rather taken aback, you know, by that from that aspect of the film.
Which, may I ask, which sort of, what was the surrounding in which you saw the film?
There was an early market screening. It was before the festival had started.
I see. That's very interesting because I saw it at the Salle Agnès Varda, and it was filled. The team, the crew was there, and it was filled with primarily an Asian audience. And everyone had a very, very strong reception to this film. They even started chanting Lo Ye's name at the end of the film. And there were people next to me who were emotionally shook and moved by this. And I think in some sense, maybe because of my ethnic background as well, I was also moved. The film does such an interesting thing, but then I also felt a little bit, I wouldn't say manipulated, but it was a smart way to approach COVID, but I understand that this has also become a genre almost type
but
of film to be making.
Let's specifically we talk can, about how does it do that?
Yeah.
How does it tackle COVID?
Yeah, we have a group of filmmakers out of the sudden being locked down in a hotel where they hope to stay in order to shoot the film. But
in Wuhan, right?
In Wuhan, okay. that is very important because it's basically the first days of COVID and everything turns into chaos. We have a scene where filmmakers want to escape hotel, but they're not able to because they've been locked down. And at some point, they're just there. And that's another repetition, layer of repetitions that we sort of facing. And as with all those lockdown films, we start to experience the mundane through a filter of absurd, I guess. And we can see how deranged this reality is and how difficult it is to cope with it, even though it seems it's just being locked in a room. But it's actually more than that because they're disconnected from their families and there's a lot of attention given to the relationships between filmmakers themselves, but also with their relationship with their families. And that is very touching. I remember pandemic that wasn't that severe for us, I think, in Europe as it was in the context of zero COVID policy, but also before that, the early days of pandemic. And I remember talking with people on Skype, on Zoom, and that was just very exhausting. But here we have an image of families just really struggling to be together. And the main protagonist who played in this discovered film, this unfinished film, we got to see his perspective that he can't go back to his wife and he's just really missing her. And there is another perspective of a group of filmmakers being close in one space. And after all, filmmaking is a collective process. Mm-hmm. And they're sort of, you know, they cannot make that process going on because they're locked down. But what they can do is that they can share that collectivity, although individually in a sense, because everybody is locked down in their own respective room. So what they can do is to have those drink parties over a Zoom call, which we all know, but I guess it's also In a way, it was refreshing to see those parties from Louie as he's sort of having fun with it, and he's filmmakers as well. So for me, there was just good energy coming from these films. But you mentioned, Eliana, you mentioned emotional response to the film. And I also was in Agnes Varda's hall, but it was just the next day morning screening where there were not a lot of people, but there were majority of those people were actually, I think, from China. Mm. And for me, the film itself was very emotional, but it was more emotional because the presence of those people, because I think it won't be a spoiler because we know, everybody probably know what happened, but after China finally opened after like 4 months after very severe lockdown, people in Wuhan finally went to the streets, and there is this one short moment in the film where we hear person just crying and shooting a footage on her mobile phone. And that was just for me, just very intense. Mm. That was very intense. I didn't...
Yeah, and I think all the while the traffic lights are stopped or something.
And everyone is honking their horn for 3 minutes straight.
Yeah, the siren for Wuhan. It was very, very intense. I didn't expect that. And just the tone of the film shifts at some point, because we just before that, we have like moment of playing around, fooling around, just people having fun because they're also tired of that situation and that setting. But there is a lot of that collective experience being enrooted in that story, and that is not created from the scratch, because it's recreated from the footage found probably online, probably from different people, but this moment of re-experiencing this on a collective ground, that was something that I didn't anticipate to hit me that hard. And there was one person in the room, sitting in the same row. I was sitting on the left, she was sitting on the right. Mm. And that person started to cry so much during the film, and she couldn't stop till the end of the credits. And I basically stayed there to feel that sort of experience as well, to be a part of it. I felt like I'm sort of intruder of that, but also privileged to sort of be a part of it. And I myself just started to cry because of I felt her very, very much. And then that film, it would be very different if I watched it alone on the screener, perhaps. Mm-hmm. But it turned out to be very emotional and very powerful, but also just so delightful in the context of, you know, there is some genuine love to cinema in this film, even though the topic is socially conscious and very actual. The topicality is there, but even so, it's also just resort to just pure joy of experiencing cinema, having fun about cinema, the collective process of filmmaking as well, which I really appreciate during watching the film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and two aspects that I still wanted to address here is, first, I think it's interesting how this movie transitions from presenting us this temporal distance. You know, we go back in time to that computer, we go back in time to that film that was once not completed, and then we go to geographical distance. You know, then we have all these people who are disconnected from one another, and who, as you said, Łukasz, they have to use a lot of Zoom calls and other, you know, there are scenes when our protagonist, when he falls asleep with the screen open, seeing his wife. And also, I think in these Zoom calls, when they have these drink parties, basically, I think the overall approach of docufiction works a bit better than in other scenes. I don't think it always comes together so naturally. I think it's a bit contradictory, not in a productive sense, but rather, I don't know, it's... But in those scenes, the film actually acknowledges that those are staged, because we first see them through the front camera, you know, singing, karaoke, dancing. But then we see the actual film cameras that film them from the side. And yeah, I think that worked very well as well. I have also heard from a friend of mine who went to another screening. I think that wasn't in the Agnes Varda, maybe it was, but... he said that a lot of people were confused, you know, and I feel like, how is that possible at a festival like Cannes? Like, how, like, at a film festival generally, like, how can you not understand that this is, you know, a reenactment, that this is not a documentary? Many people were actually, yeah, at a loss for understanding. Yeah, anyway.
Maybe just because of the proximity of the characters, because some of them are playing themselves and there's a lot of, probably a lot of improvisation, a lot of...
Would you have found it more effective if Louis had also acknowledged the presence of the camera that films our protagonist, because he's by himself all the time in his hotel room? But of course, if you think about it, this cannot be a documentary because, you know, this filmmaker who films him is never acknowledged in that film except for these like Skype scenes. And I think there it doesn't quite work for me.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I think I never really think of that during the screen. I mean, I thought of whether it's staged or not, but it doesn't really matter for me, because what matters most is what it's tried to convey, what it wants to try to tell. And for me, it was just, I guess, organic, the way they approached that. And it's, well, I was thinking, because some of those people I kind of recognized for their position in filmmaking, where they're not like big names, because most of them are like independent filmmakers, but they felt like genuine characters. And for me, whether or not they were like real people playing themselves or just actors, didn't really matter that much. Even though I could be confused, it didn't matter as well, because it's part of the experience. And I think the bigger message is that it's tried to tell a story of different sort of systems that we're put in, how severe the experience can be. Yeah, also what is the state of filmmaking in the moment like this? Whether making a film is actually bringing anything in the context of being locked down and being devoid of the possibility to physically meet with someone, and the physicality of film as well. Where does it really end in the context where you can't make a film because you're sitting in different rooms at the same hotel, but you can't really do anything, you can't really escape it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they also do talk about censorship, right? That the film might not be, you know, greenlit anymore. Mm-hmm. I think the original film was a queer story as well, right?
Yes. Yeah, I think when I was watching the film too, to speak to what you were saying earlier, Patrick, is just also when he starts having video calls with his wife and we see the entirety of the video call. And then I thought, okay, this is what they're doing now. And then it's only a little bit later that the stand-in director, who looks like Lo Ye, says, you should record all of your conversations and all of your interactions. So this was, to me, the transparency there that subtly revealed what they're doing. But I find often that this, even if one can say, oh, perhaps it's a manipulation, oh, I'm confused, is this real, is this not real? But I think that boundary blurring is really effective in some sense, which is actually starting many things that I've seen recently, including maybe Kapadia's A Night of Knowing Nothing, has done something more. It just, because perhaps that is the future of art and cinema. I mean, it is kind of in some sense too, but for it to also be recognized in the film itself and in the process that, oh, this is not necessarily presented as solely true or untrue, something that happened or didn't happen. And the futility of just the idea of restarting a film 10 years later and then having it be halted by COVID and then still trying to make something from that, and that in itself becoming it, is something cathartic happened.
Coming back to your question about how is it possible in the festival environment to have that sort of perception, maybe it's related to Western context, because every now and then I come to that answer, perhaps, that a lot of people from the Western field of culture just need the specific answer, whether or not this is A or B, whether or not this is fiction or documentary. And it comes with this more intellectual perspective of understanding things. But this duality of things also, like you said, Eliana, it's, I think it brings this interesting dynamics, because the whole process of wondering might be more important than finding an answer. And I think it's also somehow connects with Jiajuan Ke and Called by the Tides, where there is also a lot of this, the aspect of blurring the line, the aspect of not knowing whether this is a fiction or documentary, when it was shot, was it really shot or rendered? Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of this ambiguity that comes with that dynamics as well.
We will totally accept that transition. And let's go to Jiajuan Ke. Eliana, because you speak Mandarin, you understand Mandarin. Could you tell us about the perhaps poetic depth of the title? Because it also... Here it was translated as Caught by the Tides, but...
Caught by the Tides,
I heard that Jiajuan Ke, for instance, prefers the title The Drifting Generation, or like a Drifting Generation. Mm-hmm. But there are also other meanings implied there as well, right?
Yeah, literally, if you divide Feng and Liu, Feng means wind, Liu means to sort of to drift or to move... Yidai means generation, but feng liu together sometimes can mean romantic. It could also mean something that's outstanding.
I even heard arrogant as well.
It could be, there's always so many different meanings with one word or one combination. And
it was very cute. You know, I was in the press center and I just asked a guy who was standing next to me who looked Chinese, and then I asked you, are you Chinese? And then he said yes, and then I asked him about the title, and then he went on, and I, you know, he was thinking very hard, because apparently there are a lot of meanings that you can associate with this, and, you know, he didn't stop doing research as well on that.
Yeah.
But then at the end he told me, oh, and now he's going to interview Jiajuan Ke. So that was interesting.
Yeah, it could also mean loose or unconventional in a sense. So you could really translate this in so many different ways. And I think that the Chinese title does allow for more interpretation, even though Caught by the Tides in a Western poetic way can also mean all those things to some degree as well.
Right. And perhaps this is a film where it's most important to talk about the context as well, right? Of all the films we present today. What kind of history is that behind that film? We have a filmmaker who unearths his own archive, in a sense, goes back to more than 20 years. And his collaboration with his artistic and romantic partner, Zhao Tao, goes basically back to their first collaboration, I think, in 2002. That was...
Unknown Pleasures,
yes. And since then, they collaborate in many films. And what he does here, what Jiajuan Ke does, is he looks back and uses footage of, as Wukash has already said, takes footage from that. I haven't understood yet properly. Does he also use scenes from the film specifically, or was it only the footage that didn't make it into the films? There, I wasn't quite sure about that.
I think these are the excerpts that didn't make it to the film, but it feels like watching film that consists of different films from Jiajuan Ke. When I wrote my review, I felt that I was watching a video essay made by Jiajuan Ke on Jiajuan Ke. And it feels like it, really. It's at some point you feel that you're watching a documentary filmmaker making an essay on his own work and his body of work, and just looking back over 20 years of that footage that he managed to collect. And from what I know, he looked through like hundreds of hours of material that he had from those periods of shooting the films.
Yeah, and shot with all types of cameras in all types of aspect ratios.
Yeah, which feels like a travelogue, not only on the history of China, but also on the history of cinema, sort of, because the transition of image itself is just beautifully going and unfolding from a very grainy, low-key tape.
DV.
Yeah. To crystal clear 4K, like from 8 millimeter to 8K almost. and it feels like a very philosophical journey on what sort of direction cinema took and in what way it changed over the years. A beautiful methodology to think of and to, I think, yeah, it's very, very unique way of looking at your own work. But also it's connected with context of pandemic, because that was the moment which sparked Jajanka to look back on his work during lockdown and to get the idea of, sort of reenacting the Chao Chao, the character played by Zhao Tao.
That's good, because reenacting is a good point, because we should mention there are some scenes that were also like somewhere digitally integrated into the film, and some scenes were shot new as well.
Yes, and it feels like reenactment indeed, also because the presence of the main protagonist and also reenactment,
I don't know how to pronounce Chao. It Chao Chao,
yeah, okay. And also because of how the reenactment on the personal level of the character, but also reenactment of those, let's say, probably one of the most important moments of modern Chinese history, with China being elected for Olympics, the massive euphoria that came with it, the process of finalizing the Three George Dame, and then fast forward to pandemic as well. So there's like a travelogue through history indeed, and through many, many important moments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and if I may, in regard to the Three Gorges Dam, this seems to be like one of the central metaphors of the film, because if we think about the title of the film, Caught by the Tides, and here humans were like a China that is on the rise, and what do? They have the biggest water plant in the world, and they construct that there. And what comes along with that is that a lot of people are dislocated, have to move elsewhere. A lot of species are in danger through that. There's culture that either gets destroyed or has to be removed somewhere else, like murals and I think like tombstones, you know, and all these. They go back like 5,000 years or so. And this all has to move for this huge water plant. And the idea that this sort of flow that our protagonist is caught into, or those both are caught by, this can be stopped, actually. You can stop this flow for industrial, for economic purposes. And I think that's a very brutal, but also a very apt allegory that the film pursues here. And of course, this goes back to his 2006 film Still Life, where this features big time, because 2006 was also when the dam was opened.
That's very interesting perspective, because I when I thought of the title, I had somewhat different interpretation, but I like yours more. I like yours more, probably. But what I thought was that if you think of the phrase "catch the tide" is like something that you want to catch, like a chance, and to seize the opportunity, whether or not it is possible. But the whole process,
which economically is true, right?
Yeah. And there is also the aspect of futility that comes with it. And if we think of the character who is husband of Chao Chao, and in the same premise as in Still Life, he travels for the opportunity, for change of job, for fulfilling his China dream, so to say. And she goes after him and find him, and they travel from up north, from north to south, and but he's the one who's trying to catch the tide. But in a more generational level, they sort of, you can reverse that, and they're sort of the generation that supposedly is caught by the tide, but not necessarily, because as we see, the whole generation of Chinese people is just caught in a huge, massive melancholia that is reflecting that economic drive of China, where not necessarily China dream was possible to happen.
Yeah, I mean, the rise of China in the last, I mean, we used to say 30 years, but now it's really 40 years. And the vertical mobility of a country that following, I mean, and even during the Cultural Revolution, basically destroyed so much in order to lift the entirety of the people up to a place where they can somehow, for the greater good, in the eyes of the Chinese population, improve. And this very much in with the rise of technology, it's almost as if to see technology can somehow be the savior of the masses. And it's frightening because of what the things that you said, the destruction that occurs, the displacement, the fact that species are being wiped out. And I think that this film charts that, but charts it also from that perspective. And I think Jiajangko also said something about how this undeveloped nature of the digital developing image also paralleling with the undeveloped China that is still continuing in maybe another sense of not really quite an unfinished film, but an unfinished development. And then it being that with the story of Cao Cao and how she navigates and goes around is very, it's almost so simple, but so complex. And I find that the very end is also quite curious. I don't know if we should reveal it, but just in terms of understanding individuality and communal forwardness and moving forward, because there's also something that I personally think is quite interesting about certain hobbies, particularly running, marathons, etc., in which this is a social status in the West. And in recent years in China, there have been a lot of more marathons. And actually, people found that marathons, the Chinese people in general, were getting very hurt running marathons, which was something that was not culturally a part of what was done, either with one's time or with one's body. And this transition to running or marathon running might be even seen as an individual pursuit and something that's quite empowering. But there's also something when you visually see it, it's so sometimes alienating to see a horde of people dressed in the same way and running towards something where it seems, what are they running towards?
What a greater goal.
Yeah. And what are they running towards?
Yeah. And I think what I like about this film is that it reminds us that the more we zoom out of fiction film, the more we go into distance to it without, you know, without looking at a documentary, but the more we look at it from a temporal distance, the more we understand that fiction is actually a way of documenting our times. And I think Jiajangke understands that perfectly well here. I will also say that there is this idea that this sort of motif that I found really heartwarming, that Cao Cao, she, throughout the film, she tries her mimics, you know, she tries her facial expression, and one cannot be quite sure, does she try to convince herself or the people around her of her mimics? But there is one of the scenes that I think many people liked the most in the film, where she encounters a robot in a shopping mall or a department store, and she sort of forces herself onto this AI, onto this robot in a way. You know, the robot at some point declines very politely, but she insists. She insists of presenting her face as if to look for something that the robot is not able to give to her. So, yeah.
And I felt that was probably the biggest intimate connection she ever had during the whole story.
Oh, yeah. And
during those 20 years.
And we did not say she doesn't really talk in this film.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, yeah.
So the only means of communication we have is the facial expression, and it is text-based communication with brother Bin, that is her lover that left her behind. And I think when she left her there, that was also a time of economic regression, right? Because they are based in this coal mining city that, you know, the name is escaping me right now. But that's also the place where they...
Datong.
Yeah, and that's where they unite again. And this place is sort of an abandoned place. But there are some people who are resilient, and they try to still uphold certain cultural hubs. There is this karaoke bar, for instance, that is still running even after the heights of the Cultural Revolution and after economic prosperity. So people are here also really depicted as resilient as sort of fighting against this cord. And I like that a lot.
I also loved, you spoke about the karaoke scene. I also loved the fact that once again in Jadranka's film, we get to see how important is the meaning of pop songs. And you mentioned, Eliana, about the mob being put into motion. And I immediately started to think about the choreography of those public dances where at the public square, you have a lot of people just dancing to one same choreography, this massive body being put into motion as well, where there are songs, either like Chinese songs, but also this sort of exopop that just comes every now and then, those weird songs that are supposedly being set somewhere either in Japan because they talk about lovers singing about samurai and butterflies, which is a song that appeared in Jadranka's Unknown Pleasures, I think, as early as time goes.
And I have to say, there's this one song that is very popular from Germany that we see here in a Chinese version. Excuse me. It's a Genghis Khan, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Who's that? It's not going to come through.
Yeah.
That one? Okay. Because I did recognize that song after I saw the film, because you had mentioned it to me and you said, oh, this is a German song. And I've heard this song because everywhere in China. And I thought it was a Chinese song.
Yeah, and in Germany, you cannot escape that song. And especially even weirdly at weddings and stuff, this song is played. Mm. You cannot escape that song. It's like culturally ingrained.
Everybody wanted to be married to Genghis Khan, apparently.
Yeah, there was some... Years ago, there was another song by the same artist, I think, that is also very popular of a similar level that was also played in another Chinese film. And I was just surprised that those appear, they reappear in these films. But then sometimes I think, okay, there is some co-financing as well. And maybe they sometimes they want to place these things as well to sort of connect cultural affinities or something. Mm. Yeah. Is there something else we want to address here, or is that how we come to a close?
I wanted to actually also mention Black Dog, just briefly.
Oh,
it's
great.
It premiered in, it's a Guanghu's film, and it premiered in Onset and Regard. But since we talked so...
And it features.
Yeah, it features Jadranka as well. And it's a completely different film from Caught by the Tides. But it's also, I think it's important to highlight this as a tope, as a film that deals with this sort of displacement, change of environment and space, and how modernity affects common people, basically. And it's also one of my highlights, I think, from the festival. I really like it, and it has this very humanistic approach to storytelling, because it's, even though it talks mostly about people, it also talks through the presence of animals and how they sort of reflecting the tale of Chinese people in a more broader context as well. And Jiajunka is playing one of the sort of like mobsters, I guess, present there. He was also present during the presentation of the film, coming on stage, but he didn't stay for the film. He didn't stay for the film, yeah.
Oh, that's cute. And I heard it's sort of a crowd pleaser. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think it's because of the use of dog in a sense that I think where you have people and animals as characters, this basically the dog is a protagonist of the story. And it's a very cute one, but also a one with character. So it's a very resilient. And since it's also, yeah, there's a rather dark tale that awaits him, you can sympathize with both the character and the dog very much. And in that sense, it's that sort of storytelling that is a crowd-pleasing one. But it's also very well done film in the context of artistic values. It's also shot on a CinemaScope sort of very wide image, beautiful grainy tape, 35 millimeters, that is very just so poignant in the context of representing that environment. I don't remember where the film was shot. I think also north of China. Don't know which province specifically, but it's very poignant in the representation and that connection of grainy image with grainy soil and that desolated, almost like wasteland land environment. Beautiful in the context of image. And yeah, I think it's sort of a film that will appeal to the audiences. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. There are some other films from Asia that are also going to be in the festival. There are a couple that we're still waiting for. You mentioned that you had seen Viet and Nam, which
Yes.
is in A Certain Regard.
Yes.
Which you quite liked.
Yeah. By Tro Minh Quay. Amazing. It's so beautiful film. I just watched it today, so I'm still sort of processing everything that I've seen. But I think Vietnamese cinema has a good momentum with like Le Bao's Taste premiering a couple of years ago. And
Inside the Yellow Cocoon mm-hmm. Shell
Inside the Yellow Cocoon Shell last year. This year there was also Coolie Never Cries in Berlinale's Panorama. There was Memory Land that premiered in Busan. A lot of interesting titles. They're very intriguing for their artistic language and the cinematic language they use, but also for the locality they integrate within these stories. So Vietnam, a beautiful tale on how Vietnam still remembers old tales of violence, of collective traumas, and how it is ingrained into land. So there's another connection of land and memory in this film, similar to many, many other Southeast Asian films in this during this year's. But this one is so beautiful, like really beautiful.
And you know, just based on this very premise, it reminds me also of RMN, you know, just in the case that in the fact that we have the country almost in the title, and then it tells us something especially about rural Romania, you know, the film from 2 years ago. And yeah, but I will definitely catch that in the next 2 days or so. And I just want to mention one film, but I think we won't go into that right now.
Yes.
But I just want to have a little shout out to Constanze Zhang's debut film, Blue Sun Palace, which I found quite remarkable for a debut. It stars, is it Li Kangsheng? Is that correctly pronounced?
Li Kangsheng.
Okay. Shang. Okay. Yeah. Li Kangsheng. Okay. whom we all love as a constant collaborator with Tsai Minh-Yang. And yeah, it's a very interestingly structured, not even love story, but it takes some turns that might not be expected if you start the film. I think it has great chemistries of the protagonists, of the lead actors. It has an opening scene that won me over immediately. It's a lot about how food sort of connects people. And it's all taking place in New York, but you never get that impression. You know, you always think you are somewhere in China or Taiwan. And yeah, because you never really leave these places, which I think is also so central to this film, that you are sort of bound to these places because you work all the time and people expect you at these places. And yeah, we won't go into that too much, but Eliana, do you want to share as well? And want to?
Yeah, it's a very sensitively shot and made initial debut. It's about social enclaves in some sense, because you think of immigration populations that come to New York. In New York, you have Sunset Park, Chinatown, Manhattan, Bensonhurst, Brooklyn, Flushing, Queens, which is majority Korean, and even like a small Taipei. So you have different areas, and some of them speak Mandarin Chinese, some of them speak Cantonese Chinese. In the East Village, you have like Fujianese or Cantonese speakers often.
And here we are in
Flushing, and we're with the Taiwanese immigrants who come, but they also sit in Fujianese restaurants from time to time. And we follow two masseuses, and it's a story about grief in a sense as well, but it's a very well and structured film.
And you know, to me, it was almost surprising to hear Li Kangxiang talk so much, you know, because I'm not used to him talk.
But it's funny because he's started to work a lot with like independent filmmakers
from China.
Mm-hmm. I've seen Sonata of Wave just now in Jeonju Film Festival, mm-hmm. where he is actually sort of a leader of a surfing group.
Oh, wow.
And he talks, he smiles, and he's also having a lot of sad faces, which we are used to. But he's not surfing, but he's a leader of a surfing group. So, yeah.
Yeah, I have heard that he doesn't want to be so stigmatized to, like, you know, like to be just this one collaborator for this one filmmaker. He wants to. And then I think he pursues his own directorial pursuits as well. Yeah, so maybe we bring it to a close here, right? We are really far advanced. But since we still have you here, Łukasz, just can you give us like an overall impression on the festival? Because I think to me, it's a rather weak rendition of the festival. I've never been to a Cannes Film Festival where I haven't seen a few good highlights. For me, it were a few very good films, but not something that blew me away, you know, and if I just look back to last year, where I had quite a few, like About Dry Grasses, I found incredible, Inside the Yellow Cocoon Shell. And there were a few films that immediately come to mind. And I don't have that this year so strongly, but I don't know how you feel about that.
I think it's somewhat disappointing. I felt that I'll have way more films that I will be just intrigued by. And Kanzan specifically, I think, was a bit of a disappointment this year. Wherein last year I had way more discoveries. This year I'm watching way more from Uncertain Regard, and there's a couple of films that I liked, but they're not like anything that blew me away. I think Vietnam is one of the first standouts from Uncertain Regard for me. And then from competition, I really resonated with Sean Baker's film. Sorrentino's film was also somewhat a surprise for me. I didn't anticipate that, but it really spoke to me. Just clicked with the right moment, I guess, in one way. I'm still sort of processing Miguel Gomez's film.
I saw that too earlier.
So I'm not really convinced by it, but I'm also thinking about many things that are present in this film. But overall, yeah, I'm sort of, I think I expected more. But yeah, maybe these are that sort of films that will resonate with time. We never know. Maybe they will stay and remain somewhere, and we'll think of it next year as not necessarily as that disappointing as we initially thought so.
Yes, there's a special heart for films that on first impact doesn't really hit, but then one thinks about them.
Yeah, maybe that's the case.
Yes. And finally, if people are looking for you, where can they find you?
And your work?
I live in Warsaw. And sometimes I'm in Japan, but I'm on Twitter, Tinted Magenta. Where I post my work usually. I write for Movie, Asian Movie Pulse, Senses of Cinema, and many Polish outlets, and of course, Five Flavors Asian Film Festival. It takes place in November, and it's one of the biggest Asian cinema-focused festivals in Europe, and in the world perhaps as well. But it's a nice place. Not a big festival, but very dedicated to the so-called mission of promoting cinema, especially in the context of Asian cinemas. So if you're happening to be in Poland in November, which is not the perfect timing to be in Poland, but it's a good timing to be in the cinemas. Then please visit Five Flavors. I think it's a good opportunity to get to know more about cinemas of Asia.
It was also a very good time having you on the podcast, and we might in our next episode talk perhaps about the Sean Baker, right, among other films.
Yes,
it's the first film, by the way, that made it above the 3-star threshold, you know, this year. So that okay. tells you something about the
these
festival as
daily
well.
Rankings. Yes.
Okay.
All right. But thank you once again, Łukasz, for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It was really, really nice.
Bye bye.
Bye bye.
Bye.